I think Alaska will have to be looked at differently than post offices in the other 49 states.
The Postal Service considers closing some remote offices. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, July 26th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, dentists in the lower 48 look to an Alaska model to fill gaps in care.
There were about 1,000 people on the waiting list at every clinic. And that meant to get routine care, it could take up to 2 years.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
The U.S. Postal Service is again looking at closing post offices in Alaska to save money. Locations in the state survived a round of cuts a few months ago, but now the Postmaster General has announced a list of more than 3,600 offices throughout the country being examined for closure or relocation. 36 of them are in Alaska. They are scattered throughout the state, from Minto and Manly Hot Springs in the interior to Anvik and Red Devil in the southwest. The closures are not a done deal. The 36 Alaska locations will be evaluated by the Postal Service, but they ended up on the short list for reasons including having few visitors, minimal hours, and small volume. Postal Service spokesman Ernie Swanson in Seattle expects the Alaska offices to be given different consideration than those in communities with numerous locations.
The decision on what post offices ended up on the list was largely made at Postal Service headquarters, and it's kind of a numbers game back there. And Alaska is unique in terms of the remoteness of offices, the distances between offices, the lack of transportation, even roads between offices. So I think Alaska will have to be looked at differently than post offices in the other 49 states.
Alaska senators are already fighting to keep the Alaska offices open. Senator Lisa Murkowski put out a statement today calling community post offices a necessity, not a convenience. And Senator Mark Begich has reached out to the Postmaster General. They've successfully fought back plans to downsize Alaska Postal Service in the past. A few months ago, Alaska offices were removed from a list of places targeted for closure. And Ernie Swanson says Alaska also ducked a round of cuts a few years ago.
Alaska to this point has been spared from these lists, but the Postal Service continues to lose money at a critical pace. We're losing about $23 million every day, and we just can't continue to in business that way, obviously.
If post offices do close, the USPS is proposing a plan to move mail service in some communities to other local retailers, such as grocery stores. They'd be able to sell stamps and basic flat rate packages, or what was once a post office might be downgraded to an automated kiosk. In all, the Postal Service is considering shutting more than 10% of its offices nationwide. It hopes to save $200 million annually. USPS is in a deep financial hole and expects to lose $8 billion this year. To see a full list of the post offices being considered for closure, go to our website, alaskapublic.org. When it comes to dental care in rural Alaska, the need far outweighs available care. To help solve the problem, the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium began training mid-level providers, or dental health aid therapists. Now, 6 years later, a large group of dentists from the lower 48 came to visit the Alaska-based program to see if they could mirror the efforts back home. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning-Barnes reports.
There are no empty chairs in the waiting room at the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation Dental Clinic in Bethel. And it's just an average day. The clinic is always busy, seeing patients from 56 villages in an area the size of Oregon. Although the dental needs are great, care is slowly becoming more available. Of the state's 17 dental therapists, 4 are in the YK Delta working out of subregional clinics.
Screen all the kids in the school, and just try to get as much done as we can, educate the kids while we're at the schools and while we have them in the chair in the clinic too. So
Conan Marat is one of the first dental therapists in the state. He's Yupik Eskimo, originally from Bethel. For the last 6 years, he's been working out of a sub-regional clinic in Aniak, located 150 miles upriver from Bethel. But today he's in the Bethel clinic, helping to educate 25 visiting dentists on what he does. He tells them his patients travel in from a dozen villages by plane, boat, or snow machine, or he will do the traveling.
Yeah, a lot of times they'll have to wait for us to come. If they can't pay their own way to come to me, then they'll wait for me to go to them.
The visiting dentists come from 15 different states, including Frank Catalanato, a dentist and the chair of the Department of Community Dentistry at the University of Florida.
In Florida, our numbers are proportionately the same. A large portion of the population that cannot access dental care because either they can't find a dentist who takes Medicaid or they can't afford the fees.
He says the geography and cultures are different in Alaska, but dental care is a problem throughout the country.
We could use a therapist model in Florida, working for private dentists, working for federally qualified community health centers. So I would love to see this model brought to my state because the needs are absolutely tremendous.
The dental therapists that we've seen here today provide fantastic care. I've seen it. They're as good as I am at doing the procedures that are within their scope of practice.
Terry Batliner is the Associate Director of the Center for Native Oral Health Research at the Colorado School of Public Health. He also has a private practice near Boulder, Colorado. He was not only impressed with the skill of the Alaska therapists, but with how the program is managed.
I've been in two dental schools, and I got to say, the degree of organization that I saw in this program compared to dental schools, I think this is better. It is better organized. There is more control, there is more standardization. It's really a well-run program.
Batliner says his research on Indian reservations in the lower 48 is showing that they could have the highest rate of early childhood decay in the world.
And there are way too few dentists. Even if every vacancy is filled in the Indian Health Service, there are not near enough dentists to serve the need that's on those reservations. So I hope we can move this down there.
Cincinnati dentist Larry Hill says funding is a major problem. For 30 years, Hill worked as the dental director for the Cincinnati Health Department, where he oversaw 10 dentists and 5 clinics. He says there was never enough care to meet the city's needs.
There were about 1,000 people on the waiting list at every clinic. And that meant to get routine care, it could take up to 2 years.
Clearly, he says, there are similar needs for dental therapists in the lower 48.
If I had, instead of having 10 dentists, if I had 2 or 3 dentists to do the more difficult work and took the other 7 dentists and made them therapists instead of dentists, I saved the community somewhere between $350,000 and $450,000 a year.
The dentist's trip to the Bethel Clinic was sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium and the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, which has been a longtime financial supporter of the program. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a study reveals a large gender pay gap in Juneau.
You can't be passive about this because the odds are, according to all these statistics, you're going to get paid less.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
Men in Juneau earn significantly more money than women, according to an economic indicator in a recent JEDC newsletter. The Juneau Economic Development Council analyzed data from the U.S. Census Bureau's American Community Survey that shows men in the capital city make 42% more than their female counterparts. Of course, the problem isn't unique to Juneau. Nationwide, the same survey indicates men earn 29% more than women. Statewide, it's 37%. And as always, numbers only tell part of the story. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
As a lifelong Junoite, Melanie Shivens was more than a little surprised when she crunched the American Community Survey numbers as part of her job at the Juneau Economic Development Council.
Because we have so much employment in the public sector, where the discrepancy between wages tends to be smaller, my expectation was that Juneau would have more wage parity in terms of gender.
Indeed, the results show the gender wage gap for Juneau public employees, local, state, and federal government workers is smaller than the national and statewide averages. But the gap for private sector and nonprofit employees is off the charts.
In the for-profit sector, men earned 65% more than women. And in the nonprofit sector, we actually found it to be 82% more for men.
Shiven says she generally finds the American Community Survey to be pretty reliable, but in this case, she wanted more research to back it up. The most recent gender wage gap information from the State Department of Labor was from 2006, while the ACS data was collected between 2007 and 2009. So Shiven says she's reluctant to compare those results.
We're still looking into why it's so much higher in Juneau and why it's so much higher in the for-profit and nonprofit sectors. We haven't had a chance to really dig down and find some answers to answer all those questions.
Shivens notes the ACS data is based on a survey of 744 households with a high margin of error, plus or minus 8.9% for all job categories and 17.1% for the nonprofit category. State economist Molly Abrahamson says the Labor Department uses more accurate information collected from employers filing quarterly unemployment insurance documents.
We get a more complete census of what employers are paying.
For Barbara Belknap, any pay disparity is too big. She's taken on the issue as something of a crusade.
There have been lots of laws passed beginning in 1963 with pay equity law. And then there have been, you know, you name it, Fair Pay Act, Act for Fair Pay, please, please, please. Then each time there's some kind of a loophole.
The former director of the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, Belknap, says the wage gap is particularly troubling to her in a state that many women see as a land of opportunity.
And it is, but the likelihood is that you are not going to get paid the same.
Now retired, Belknap has started collecting personal stories from women and men who've experienced gender pay inequality firsthand. She's not sure what she'll do with the stories, but for now is sharing them with politicians and community groups. One thing she'd like to see, classes for women to teach salary negotiation skills.
You can't be passive about this because the odds are, according to all these statistics, you're going to get paid less.
One piece of good news from both the Census Bureau and State of Alaska numbers, both men and women in Juneau get paid more than the national and state averages. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
The parent company that owns Alaska News Incorporated, Calista, is the regional Alaska Native corporation for the YK Delta. When Calista bought Alaska newspapers almost 20 years ago, they bought with it the Tundra Drums newspaper. The paper reached their core audience, Yupik shareholders in the remote southwest part of the state. KYUK reporter Shane Iverson talked with people in Bethel to get a feel for what it means now that the paper is closing down.
More than 20 years ago, and long before the Tundra Drums was owned by Calista, Kathy Hansen delivered the paper in Bethel.
When it was the only newspaper in town, and people would literally follow me from the airport to find where I was going to drop off the next group of papers so they could get them. That's how anxious people were to get the Tundra Drums. It was such a good paper.
As a paper girl, Hansen says she had her work cut out for her.
Sometimes it was 36 or 30-some pages long.
That was at a time when the Drums was the only show in town, so to speak, before cable television was a common feature in Bethel and village households, and long before the internet. Andre Jacobs of Bethel remembers reading the Drums as a child, but he said in the modern times, it simply couldn't keep up.
I want to get on and I want to find my information immediately. That's just the day and age that we live in, and it's not going to go back to any time back in the 1800s, the 1900s, the 1980s, or the 1990s.
Like many newspapers around the world, ANI seemed to be working against the hands of time. It was widely believed in the YK Delta that Alaska's only news chain was not making money. Calista has never publicly disclosed the financial details of their subsidiary, but former Calista board member Arvin Dole of Bethel agrees with the decision by the board to pull the plug.
I just think it'll be better for the shareholders, and I'm glad the board made the right decision.
Of the five readers I interviewed for this piece, only one said the paper was still a big part of their lives. That was Lori Hunter.
Everyone reads it to find out what's going on. If they don't hear it on the news, they need to read the paper.
More common was the thoughts expressed here by Hansen.
The Tundra Drums started kind of getting back on their feet, and really doing a lot better in the last couple of years. So I was kind of surprised as it seemed like it was improving.
In fact, the Tender Drums is currently recognized as the best weekly newspaper in Alaska, an award bestowed upon it by the Alaska Press Club. At the helm of the paper at the time it was recognized was Alex de Marbon. When he won the award, he says he was just one of six full-time reporters for the entire ANI chain.
You know, we used to have at least 20 full-time employees working statewide. These are reporters and editors as a chain.
As part of cost-saving measures, several years back, ANI shut down the offices in Bethel and elsewhere, hoping that the paper could be pulled off cheaper in a central location in Anchorage.
I think it saved some costs, but it obviously hurt some quality.
Recently, the Drums relocated a reporter to Bethel, but for many readers, like Jacobs, it was too little, too late.
It didn't emotionally connect with the people here the way it was originally intended to do.
Instead of short stories on local happenings, de Marbon says he was forced to concentrate on bigger, hard-hitting issues. Suicide, global warming, public safety, those all became the major focuses of the small paper. It earned him several awards, and according to a press release by Senator Lisa Murkowski, the ANI chain was able to provide a voice to the underserved. De Marbon says that was his intent.
When you look at the state of Alaska overall, there's just not a lot of rural journalists, and so I felt like I was always doing something important, and that was always very special to me, and so always very rewarding as well.
Despite the accolades, he says the writing has been on the walls for some time.
But I can't say that I was totally surprised by the closure, because I just know that the newspaper business is so difficult. Honestly, I'm surprised that the rural newspapers were able to stick it out as long as they did, two decades essentially.
As for Bethel and the YK Delta, Hansen says she hopes the other local newspaper can fill the void.
Thank goodness we have the Delta Discovery, but I mean, for Bristol Bay and Kotzebue, I mean, that is really too bad to not have a local newspaper. That's really very disappointing.
Chalista says the last newspapers will be printed sometime in August. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The future of how Alaskans will produce the energy we need for our homes and businesses is uncertain. The Renewable Energy Alaska Project is committed to developing Alaska's vast renewable energy resources to create a clean, local, and sustainable energy supply. Learn more at realaska.org. This message sponsored by REAP, committed to creating a sustainable economic future for Alaska.
A former leader of the Inuit Circumpolar Conference and a prominent Alaska Native traditional science advocate has died. Caleb Pingawi was born in the St. Lawrence Island community of Savunga in 1941. Pingawi's list of accomplishments is lengthy. He was a past president and CEO of ICC, as well as for Nome-based Native nonprofit Kowarik Incorporated. He served on many boards and committees that had direct involvement in the oversight of marine mammals and Arctic Ocean ecosystems. At the time of his death, he was a senior advisor for the conservation group Oceana. Pingawi's brother-in-law, Mike Scott, says because Pingawi grew up living off the land and water, he was instrumental in helping bridge the sometimes contentious relationship between environmentalists, Western science, and Alaska Native people.
To ensure that future generations would be able to continue subsistence hunting and fishing and working with the scientific community to understand some of the understandings that the Native community has about mammals and wildlife that they may not really know and understand using Western scientific techniques. And so he was a real bridge to that community from the Arctic Ocean to Antarctica. You know, his contribution, I think, will be lasting for sure.
Pingawi had been on the Nome City Council and was at one time the city manager for Kotzebue. He worked with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife and Park Service, documenting resources to help ensure proper management, especially from a Native perspective. Scott says he believes Pingawi would want to be remembered for his hard work in this area.
His role in helping his people be able to continue the subsistence way of life, as well as the culture and heritage to remain strong and not lose that identity. I think that was top on his list, and he practiced, what he preached, and was a great ambassador for the Native community, and he'll be missed.
Pingaui had lymphoma. He died yesterday at his home in Wasilla. He was 69 years old. He is survived by his wife Gladys, 9 children, 24 grandchildren, and 5 great-grandchildren. A funeral service will be held at the First Baptist Church of Anchorage on Saturday at 3 p.m. The Tlingit language includes 50 letters, including some sounds that are not found in other languages. A new online tool plus note card and audio system is aimed at helping children learn the language, but it can help students of any age. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has more.
Star.
Kutch-yana-ha.
Octopus.
Na.
Jellyfish.
Tauk-anasi.
That's Ralph Wolf and Marsha Hotch presenting selections from the Tlingit alphabet. Their voices are part of a new online audiovisual teaching program created by the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute. It's also part of a note card and CD audio system teaching the written language's 50 letters.
One of my first teachers said, before you can say a sound or word, you have to be able to hear that sound.
Linda Bilardi creates Tlingit language curriculum for the Institute.
And because they're new to English speakers, we figure the more ways that they can have to learn and hear those sounds, then it's going to make it a little bit easier when they get into the books or and try to say something.
The Institute is sending alphabet card and CD packages to 15 Southeast Alaska language teachers. Others can use the online version or request copies. They're also on sale to the general public.
We asked our artists to draw pictures that would appeal to young children, but it's actually for any age. You know, the sounds are new, and so any tool that we have for learning language is applicable to any age.
Tlingit was an oral language. The written version, developed after Western contact, is made up of letters used by English speakers. The less familiar ones are depicted by combinations of those letters, plus apostrophes called pinches and underscores. Bilardi says some of those are unique.
They look like X, so we want to say like X-ray, but they're not the same in Tlingit. And those are the four sounds, the four X sounds that are not found in any other language.
So you'll hear these sounds. In these words,
dogfish,
kutku,
boots,
kwan,
fire,
kwan,
down feathers,
kwat.
Bilardi says they may be unfamiliar to the uninitiated, but they're easier to memorize because they never change. That's not the case in English, where, for example, a G can be hard, as in goat, or soft, as in giant. The new release, called Let's Learn Tlingit, joins other native language publications and online tools created by the Heritage Institute. They include Tlingit Haida and Tsimshian dictionaries, plus phrase and spelling books. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
An Alaska Native language expert at UAF hopes that the term Diné will catch on among Athabascans in Alaska because he says it will help preserve their culture and language. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
UAF linguistics professor Gary Holton says he hadn't realized the importance of using the term Dene instead of Athabascan until he heard a speaker at a native language conference last month in Whitehorse.
I was listening to a man by the name of Bruce Starlight, who is from the Tsuut'ina Nation in Alberta, Canada. And he was making the argument that the term Athabascan was a foreign term, a derogatory term applied by outsiders, and was not appropriate to be used, and we needed to come up with a better term and should use instead this term Dene.
Holton says he was impressed by Starlight's talk because he and many other linguists and indigenous people have for years debated the use of the word Athabascan to refer to a group of North American native languages and the people who speak them.
And Dene is this word that usually spelled D-E-N-E with some variations, and this is the word for person in many of those languages, and it's a very It's a very reasonable choice as a name for a language or culture group.
Reasonable because to many Dene people, the term Athabascan, like the term Eskimo, is a designation coined by Europeans that has come to be considered in recent years at best inexact and at worst, to some, an insult.
Now, Eskimo is maybe, you know, has been asserted to mean a lot of different things. In the end, it's not really literally derogatory, but what counts as derogatory is extremely subjective, right? If I decide I don't like this name applied to me, then that counts as derogatory.
Holton says hearing the indigenous presenters at the conference in Whitehorse made him wonder whether the people who speak the 11 Athabascan languages in Alaska also are rethinking about how to refer to themselves. Holton says while in Whitehorse, he logged on to the UAF Native Language Center website. He's the director of the center. And after some research, he posted an entry on the blog that he maintains on the site. The blog entry includes a list of spellings and very similar sounding pronunciations of the word Dene as it's spoken in those 11 languages.
Most of those are pronounced something like Dene or Dene or Dene. Or something like that, right? So Dene or something like that is a pretty good fit.
Holton says the idea seems to be slowly catching on among Alaska Natives who speak those languages. Robert Charlie at Dena Ina Elder from Minto agrees, and he says it's just one example of the need to revisit the importance of Alaska Natives' cultural identity and influence on Alaska. The former executive director and founder of the Fairbanks-based Cultural Heritage and Education Institute says geographic place names, for example, also should more accurately reflect the names given by indigenous peoples.
My hope is to get a group together, concerned groups, about trying to correct all these words.
Jonathan Ross, a Dena Ina who serves as president and CEO of the Alaska Native Heritage Center in Anchorage, says greater use of the term Dene also would help build unity.
I think it could be used to highlight the importance of our own language and our own ways of designating ourselves, because Athabascan really is not our own term.
In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Angela Denning Barnes and Shane Iverson in Bethel, Casey Kelly and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. Timing is everything. A mother who waits until her child is at least 2 years old before becoming pregnant again is making the best decision for herself and her baby. The mother has a better chance of regaining health and energy between pregnancies, and her baby has a better chance of being born on time and at a good weight. Talk to your health care provider to find out how to plan your pregnancies. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.